Hi, Katie here, just hopping on quick before the episode to remind you I am co-leading a pilgrimage to Ireland this coming October 2024. Come join me and Christy Eisinger on a magical tour through the Emerald Isle, Our Lady of Knock, St. Patrick's Holy Mountain, the Rock of Cashel, the Cliffs of Moher, ancient monasteries, high tea at a castle, traditional music, sheep herding demonstrations, a literary pub crawl. This trip has it all, and we've made sure to keep a pace that is both adventurous and relaxing, with time to explore on your own, make new friends, pray, eat, and travel carefree with the expert local guides provided by Select International. Check out the show notes to download the brochure and sign up today. Sláinte! Hi, I'm Katie Marquette, and you're listening to Born of Wonder.
And here there is something more than just a transient experience.
It's about being. It's about the things that matter to me. It's about the white spaces between the paragraphs.
Then God said, "Let there be light."
The mistake you always made, Doc, trying to love a wild thing.
What we would like to do is change the world, make it a little simpler for people to feed, clothe, and shelter themselves as God intended them to do. And by fighting for better conditions, by crying out unceasingly for the rights of the workers, the poor, of the destitute, the rights of the worthy and the unworthy poor. In other words, we can, to a certain extent, change the world. We can work for the oasis, the little cell of joy and peace in a harried world. We can throw our pebble in the pond and be confident that its ever-widening circle will reach around the world. We repeat, there is nothing we can do but love. And dear God, please enlarge our hearts to love each other, to love our neighbor, to love our enemy as our friend. Dorothy Day. Hello and welcome to Born of Wonder. I'm Katie Marquette, and on this podcast we explore anything and everything that inspires wonder and awe in the world. Back with you after a small little mid-season hiatus. I've got some great interviews now to share with you. So excited. This interview I actually did last summer. It's just one of those, it was such an excellent chat I had. I was so thrilled to talk to Larry Chapp. I'm a fan of his writing, fan of his work. And it was just one of those things that just, you know, I needed to work on it and edit it, and it just didn't happen. And life just came at me, and then I kept sort of waiting for the perfect time to release it, and I just kept waiting. So now seems like the time, and so I'm so excited. I'm so excited to share this with you. Dr. Chapp is a writer, a theologian, a speaker, and he also owns, operates a Catholic worker farm. So that's pretty exciting, because what I really wanted to talk to him about was Dorothy Day, a confounding figure for Catholics and non-Catholics alike. Possibly will be a saint someday, we'll see. But she was just a fascinating person. She inspires sort of deep emotional responses from people, and some people want to cast her aside as a communist, but it's not that simple. We'll talk about Dorothy Day, who she was, about her faith, her deeply Orthodox faith, and how that sort of shaped her entire worldview, and what we can learn from her about how to take a Christian ethic into the world in a real way. How do we help people? What does charity look like? How do we raise our children in the world we live in the culture we live in? We talk about, what does it mean to have money as a Christian? What do you do with your money? What do you do with your time? All these things that are very important for us to ask. So we'll learn some of the details of Dorothy Day's life and her vision, and how Dr. Chapp is making that happen in his way, on his Catholic worker farm, and what that looks like, and it's a place you can go visit. So good to learn about it. And then we'll just talk more broadly about the culture and our place in it, and trying to, trying to live a good, ethical Christian life in this world, which is no easy task. So I think you'll really enjoy the conversation. And as always, you can find me online at bornofwonder.com. I'm writing away on Substack. You can find the link in the show notes. And I am co-leading a pilgrimage to Ireland in October with Christy Eisinger. And I would be thrilled if you went ahead and signed up to join us. We'll be going to Our Lady of Knock and ancient monasteries, the oldest whiskey distillery in the world, hiking, praying, laughing, drinking. It's going to be the best. So I hope you can join us. But without further ado, let's just launch into this conversation with Larry Chapp and learn more about what it means to be a Christian in the world today. Today, I am so thrilled to be joined by Dr. Larry Chapp. He is a retired professor of theology, taught for 20 years at DeSales University in Pennsylvania, and he now owns and manages with his wife the Dorothy Day Catholic Worker Farm. And you may know him from his very popular blog, Gaudium et Spes 22. His articles really make their way around the web. Great writer. I really appreciate all that he's contributing to the cultural conversation around the church. And I'm just so glad that he's here to talk with us.
Glad to be here.
So I just wanted to get your just official introduction there, but just how would you describe life these days, how you're occupying yourself, what you're interested in?
It seems like I have too many irons in the fire. Let's just put it that way right from the start. But in a nutshell, yeah, I am a retired theology professor. I loved being a teacher. I just quit loving a lot of the stuff that went along with university education these days. And I felt called to do something more radical. And so my wife and I did start the Catholic Worker Farm. But I remain in my soul a theologian and a teacher. I'm just now teaching in a different modality. And that modality is through my writings, through my YouTube videos, through my speeches that I give in various travels. But also then through the hospitality of the people that visit the farm. Even more than the farming side of the farm, it seems like more and more, it's that what Dorothy Day called hospitality that dominates so much of our life here on the farm, that people just really are thirsting for prayer and conversation and fellowship more than weeding vegetable plots or feeding animals or something. So it really seems that's, to answer your question, a great deal of my time and my wife's time these days is taken up with hosting visitors to the farm, almost more than anything else.
You know, hosting is no small feat. That in and of itself is hugely time consuming. So I wanted to talk about, mostly with you today, I wanted to talk about Dorothy Day, who I'm very interested in, but know relatively little about, certainly compared to you. And I think that Dorothy Day has a lot to offer. So I'm a Catholic convert and all my family, not religious, many of my friends, not religious at all. And I find Dorothy Day to be a very interesting figure to bring up because she's very compelling, I think, to people outside of the faith tradition as well, because she's a mix of contradictions. She's this Orthodox Catholic, but she has the quote unquote social justice bent. And I think she just has a lot to offer us. So could you, for people who aren't as familiar, just give us just the brief introduction to who was Dorothy Day?
Yeah, Dorothy Day was born in 1897, so at the very end of the 19th century. She was not born a Catholic, and she was raised in some version of Protestantism, but very lukewarm, wasn't very religious at all. And she was an aspiring journalist in New York City more than anything as a young person, in Chicago too. And she was enamored of radical social justice movements and was very sympathetic with Marxist, communist social justice movements in the United States. Her biggest concern were the poor and labor in particular. Remember, this is a time before there were labor unions, before there were like child labor laws even. And labor unions were even considered communist and controversial for a long time. We take it for granted now, but she was very much involved in this labor movement. And what she saw, she was well aware of the problems associated with communism. But in the American version of Marxist agitation, she saw the only people that were really out there fighting for the rights of labor, fighting for the rights of the workers. But long story short, she does eventually, in her questing and her seeking, discover the Catholic faith. She does, and it's still a long process of discernment, but she starts to read she becomes a Catholic and she starts reading the papal social encyclicals, like Rerum Novarum of Pope Leo XIII, and things like that. And she becomes convinced that Catholicism is the true social justice. and the true salvation and the true liberation. And she dives as she into Catholicism. She's in a sense trained theologically by this guy named Peter Morin, who was French and who left France and came to the United States, and he was a sort of self-taught theologian. But he too was a very Orthodox Catholic, like Dorothy, but still radicalized in the sense of believing that the Sermon on the Mount was something that should be lived more literally by most people, not just monks in monasteries. And she believed, like Peter, long before Vatican II, in what we call the universal call to holiness. And so they started this thing called the Catholic Worker Movement, 1933, and the Catholic Worker newspaper. And this is at the height of the Great Depression. And the movement grew in popularity until World War II. And because she and Peter Morin were both resolute pacifists, they opposed World War II. And that cost the worker movement dearly. The thousands and thousands of people that had subscribed to the paper began falling away. And it just wasn't popular, as you might imagine, to be an American at that time and opposed to World War II. But the movement survived, and it still exists today. Sadly, I think many Catholic worker houses have simply drifted into trendy left-wing politics. Not all. And even the people that have drifted into trendy left-wing politics are really good people in many ways, morally upright people that I admire. But nevertheless, it's not profoundly Catholic in many ways in some quarters. And that has led some people to the false belief that Dorothy Day wasn't a very devout Catholic, and yet she was. She was sympathetic to Marxism, though, to the day she died. She was she's a compelling figure, as you said, because she's not a cardboard cutout. She's not a holy card of what a Catholic saint is supposed to look like. She was a very complicated woman, and she wasn't always consistent with her own principles. Like, she was a pacifist, and yet she was sympathetic with Fidel Castro's revolution in Cuba in the first years of that revolution, before it became really this unholy terror that it eventually became. She did have a soft spot in her heart for communism, even though she was opposed to big government. She was opposed to the big state. She even opposed Social Security when it was first proposed by Franklin Roosevelt, because she feared the power of the government. And yet, here she also had this soft spot in her heart for communist forms of government. She even visited the Soviet Union once, not to pay homage to communism, but she was just interested in it. She was intrigued by it. So yeah, she was a woman of many contrasts, but through it all, her fundamental devotion was to Christ and the Christ of the poor and the preferential option for the poor. That was Dorothy Day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, and what you focus on more broadly in much of your writing is how we need to get back to a very fundamental Christology of understanding who Christ was as a person and what he's calling an individual to. And I think Dorothy Day's life is an example of what that call can create in a person. You wrote a great piece about the prophetic anarchy of Dorothy Day that was for the Catholic World Report. And you had a line in there that you said, "Presidents do not run the country, Goldman Sachs does." And I think that the tension that Dorothy Day saw with this large government system that she was so against and which made her so sympathetic to Marxism was clearly this reaction against big business, which to this day is you can't talk about the U.S. government without talking about big business. So I think that's what people get really hung up on, the communism aspect, but they don't think about where that criticism was coming from. And we still have to grapple with that reality today, I think.
I think that's a very intelligent and insightful thing there, Katie, that with regard to contextualizing Dorothy Day's sympathy with Marxism, she was clearly aware that totalitarianism is a bad thing. She hated Stalin. She despised oppression in all of its forms. She was not in any way, shape, or form a communist in that regard. And so one does have to peel back the layers of rhetoric and understand why is it she was sympathetic to it. And it was because she really did believe passionately that there was something profoundly wrong with the American economic system, with the economic system of the West. Yes, it generates an enormous amount of wealth. There's no doubt about that. Capitalism has generated an enormous amount of wealth and even a certain generalized prosperity. But by the same time, it has generated great corruption in our government and the collusion of the military-industrial complex, corporate America, now these days, big tech surveillance, and the ever-growing power of the centralized state. And she understood the great potential for harm and oppression that this represented. She also understood to the human soul that this kind of focus on wealth and bourgeois comforts and that sort of thing does to us. She also saw that there were still great inequities of income between the super rich and the super poor in the United States. And so she really truly believed that our economic system was deeply corrupted by these trillions of dollars that float around here, and that at the end of the day, it's oppressive to workers. She also, I think, truly believed that at the end of the day, the communists are not going to succeed. What's going to succeed globally is this kind of Western-styled capitalism. And so she considered it to be enemy number one.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure there are some people listening who maybe heard some of those phrases and, depending on their own political beliefs, will either have been excited or shut down by hearing them. And I think that is, hopefully people can open mind. I think that Dorothy Day, I want to remind people, Dorothy Day went to daily mass. She was a big proponent of the rosary. She was in favor of what we would consider the quote unquote conservative sexual ethics of the modern church that we still hold. And so that's just why I really am so fascinated with her, is that she can't quite fit into anyone's peg here. And I like that about her, because I think it shows her as a real person, because we all are a mixed up muddle of principles and ideas, and we're like trying our best to live them out. And you can disagree with the conclusion she came to, but I don't think any of us should deny that these are real problems that we need to address in one way or another.
Oh my goodness, I think that's so important to understand. One of the nettlesome things I think of our modern culture is how we frequently judge one another based on our politics. I can't be friends with you, you voted for Trump, or I can't be friends with you because you voted for Hillary or Biden. And that's unfortunate because politics is the art of prudential judgment above all else, and reasonable people can disagree. Like, I disagree with Dorothy Day's complete pacifism. I'm a pacifist in general and against war in general, but I do believe that at times it's necessary to go to war. And so I don't completely agree with her on that. I don't have a soft spot in my heart for Fidel Castro because they're fighting for the poor or some. No, I think she was inconsistent, and I don't completely agree with all of her politics. But what makes her interesting, and I think you've nailed it, is precisely her Catholicism, her deep devotion to the saints, to the sacraments, to the teachings of the church, as you correctly point out, even in matters of sexuality. Interesting. See, she believed that it's all of a piece. She understood that Catholic sexual teaching, if lived up to, has social justice implications. That in many ways, the ruling classes enjoy the fact that the lower classes are quite often caught up in self-destructive sexual practices because it keeps them in their lowly state. Dorothy understood that sexual integrity was deeply connected with the issues of social justice. And so, that to me is the most interesting. When I read her stuff, she starts talking about politics. It's like, okay, fine. But I'm more interested in what she has to say about the saints, about living out the gospel, about opening your door to the poor. That is why, if she becomes a saint someday, and I hope she does, that will be why she becomes a saint, not because of her politics. God forbid that any of us would be judged on our politics.
Oh, goodness, yeah. I have occupied every political stance, so I'm very sympathetic to, I understand how you can get in different headspaces. We actually did a podcast episode a while ago with a former Catholic lobbyist, and we talked about sort of preferencing humanity over politics, and I encourage people to go back and listen to that as well. But so you encountered Dorothy Day, you're clearly enamored with her as I am. But then you took it a step further in that you actually went and created a Catholic worker farm. Can you lead us to how you got to that point and what that looks like?
Part of it was after 20 years of teaching theology, I had begun teaching courses in Catholic social teaching and Catholic social justice. And I started coming to the same conclusions about the immorality of many aspects of American culture. So it was started to become very enamored of Dorothy Day and Peter Morin's concept that you need to build a new society from within the shell of the old, that you need to change the culture one brick at a time, that politics is downstream of culture, and therefore it's the culture, stupid. And as Bill Clinton used to say, it's the economy, stupid. No, it's the culture, stupid. And to realize, therefore, it's very much similar to Rod Dreher's concept of the Benedict option, that what the church needs to do today is to build these little small Christian intentional communities. And so I began to realize this as a teacher of social justice and Catholic theology in general, that there was this great need to build these little small Catholic communities. And the opportunity came up for my wife and I to suddenly buy this farm. And I realized this might be the Holy Spirit speaking to us to say, okay, I was, like I said, I'd done my bit for teaching for 20 years. I love teaching. I love the students. But the university world had become corrupt, in my view, and was a Catholic school, and yet all we did was chase the market and chase the latest trends, chase the latest boutique majors. We talk a good line as a school about Catholicism and social justice, but then really when you'd get into meetings on an organizational level, you began to realize that all they cared about was, number one, survival. We have to survive somehow as a school. And number two, money. How do we make money? How do we attract more students? And they didn't care. The Catholicism had to take a way, way back seat to all of those antecedent questions. And then the bureaucracy and the layers of bureaucracy and the kowtowing to the various accrediting agencies. There's a deep crisis in modern day Catholic higher education, as there's a crisis in higher education in general. And so it led me to conclude, I've done my bit here and I'm done. I now need to move into a different station in my stage in my life. And I want to build one of these intentional communities. I want to be a part of rechanging our culture brick by brick in a different way than I'm doing as a university professor. And so we did. And that's how we got here. And now I combine those two vocations, theology teacher and gentleman farmer, Catholic worker, yeah. Hospitality dude. And we've been here 10 years and we're very happy that we did. There's been a lot of ups and downs, but here we are. We're still standing.
And so the idea of the farm, do you harvest crops and then give them to the homeless?
What's interesting, what's part of the evolution, part of the ups and downs, and part of what we see, too, with regard to the whole charity industry in our country, when we only have about 12 acres. It's a small farm. It's more of a Catholic worker homestead than a farm. But still, we initially planted like 3 acres of potatoes and tomatoes and every vegetable you can possibly grow. And we started trying to give it away to various food pantries and the Catholic Worker House in New York City. And what we discovered is that they didn't want our food, that there's very little capacity in these places for taking in fresh produce and storing it and these sorts of things. And furthermore, like local food pantries, at least near us, they've gone all corporate in the sense that they are inundated with donations from local grocery stores where pallet after pallet of various foods will be delivered, spaghetti sauces, pasta, rice, cereal, all these kinds of durable goods that you can put on a shelf with a long shelf life. But the grocery stores were taking food that was about to expire within a month and giving it all away. And that it's a tax write-off for them to these nonprofits. And so we discovered that the food pantries didn't want our fresh produce. And the Catholic Worker House in New York, where we were sending like our potatoes and things, were saying, look, please, we don't have a capacity for taking. We get enough donations anyway. We don't need your stuff. So we're left scratching our head. Wait a minute. So we started giving a lot of our produce away. We started growing less produce, but we were giving it away in a targeted way. Local churches in our own parish were helping us identify the working poor, poor people that were having that worked, had homes, but were having a really hard time making ends meet. We were giving a lot of our produce to them. But then we gradually morphed from a focus on growing vegetables to the animals. We have sheep. Our primary thing is we have sheep and we have dairy goats. And we raise the sheep for their wool. And my wife processes their wool. She shears them, cleans the wool, and she spins the wool into yarn. So in other words, it's the lost art of spinning wool and weaving and knitting and making things from start to finish. And this is what Peter Morin, the co-founder of Dorothy Day, of the Catholic Worker Movement, he was the brains behind the Catholic Worker Farms. And he referred to it as cult, culture, and cultivation, the coming together of religion and culture and back to the landism. And he believed that the Catholic Worker Farms should be places where lost skills, lost artisanal skills are recovered. And so one of our focuses now is we bring people here to teach them how to do things like shear a sheep or even raise a sheep and to spin wool and to knit things. We teach them how to do things like canned tomatoes, canned potatoes. We also teach them how, we also have chickens for laying eggs. So we teach them how to take care of chickens, and then how to milk a dairy goat and what's the best way to preserve and what do you do with goat milk and so on. And then just teaching people the general skills of animal husbandry on a small scale that people can do in a small scale themselves in a way that's been lost. And then, of course, there is the what Peter Morin called roundtable discussions. And we have a chapel on our area, in our farm. It has the Eucharist reserved. We are actually Benedictine oblates. We pray the Liturgy of the Hours, as Dorothy Day was. And sometimes the groups that come here bring a priest. They say Mass in our chapel. We do Liturgy of the Hours. Then we followed by a big meal. And then we sit around and we discuss the church today, culture today, family life, theology, Dorothy Day, Christ, the Gospels. And we find, so the typical day would be visitors would come and they'd spend time out on the farm, maybe helping us weed our vegetable garden, milking a goat, collecting eggs, helping with the sheep, spinning wool. And then we do the prayer and so on. So it's like a miniature sort of farm-based retreat that people engage in. And we find that this is the bulk of our ministry now, more than growing a ton of vegetables to give away that nobody seems to want. The bulk of our ministry is more oriented towards artisanal skills, cheese making, yogurt making, spinning wool, and then the fellowship aspect of things. That's what we do here. It doesn't sound grandiose. It's pretty simple, but that's what we do.
Yeah, no, it's great. I had a lot of thoughts while you were talking, one of which was I started my career. I thought I was going to go into the NGO space. So I like interned with Save the Children and things like that and did graduate work in Africa. And I was very quickly disillusioned because I would go to these places and they could just point out the different wells and things like that had been made, but nobody ever would sustain them. Like you'd have a donor campaign to get the new well built, but 5 years later it would break and nobody would fix it. So you could just like point, be like, oh yeah, that was from USAID. That was Save the Children. That was that. And meanwhile, no one in the local community was actually being like given their own resources to do anything. They were just the feel good recipients of foreign donors, which like seemed not great to me. So I became a big fan of E.F. Schumacher and Small is Beautiful and giving them back their own responsibility over their lives. And I think that artisanal aspect is actually really important and maybe an overlooked way of engaging in sort of charitable works today, because I think this is something I wanted to talk on later, but we can bring it up now, which is that it's frustrating actually to try to do corporal works of mercy and things like that. You run into the bureaucracy very quickly. You're like, is this even helpful? Like I'm trying to be helpful. And they'll be like, there's a long wait list for volunteers or you've got to fill out this paperwork. And so I think for many Catholics today, many Catholics I know who want to be involved, who want to help, who want to be actively charitable, they don't know what to do. They don't know where to put their money. They don't know where to put their time. Do you have any advice?
Yeah, I think that the first piece of advice that I would have is don't look overseas. Look in your own backyard. Because as you correctly pointed out, so many of the aid agencies that we've given money to and stuff, 80 cents on the dollar goes to administrative costs and only 20 cents on the dollar ever makes it to the poor. Now, Catholic Relief Services is an exception to that rule. I think about 80 cents in the dollar that you send to Catholic Relief Services does eventually find trickle down to the poor and so on. But it remains anonymous. It remains still, it's like paying taxes to support the welfare state. That's all well and good. But there's a buffer between me and the end recipient. I can get a picture of some kid that I've helped, in Tanzania or something. Okay, that's great. It gives me a warm fuzzy for a bit. But how do I know that the picture's true? And there's the nagging doubt, and am I being taken for a ride? So I think the first piece of advice is, with regard to Dorothy Day, was a big believer that charity should cost us something and not just out of our wallet. It should extend us. It should provoke us. It should hurt. It should pinch. And that is why I say look locally for the sources of poverty in your own area. So one way, I think every major urban center that I know of, certainly it's on our biggest town is Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, population of about 40,000 just down the road from us. Every single city about that has a soup kitchen. And ours is run by the Vincent de Paul Society. And so I know people that volunteer to go down and help out with the soup kitchen. Also, I would say get involved in your church. Almost every single church that I know of has some sort of outreach, both Protestant and Catholic. They've got some sort of outreach ministry for identifying those people in your area that are poor and need help for you to help them. And I would also then encourage people to get involved in their parish if there is no such outreach, to in a sense start one, to be a pain in the rear end, agitate your pastor just a bit, to maybe your parish has the resources to open up its own little soup kitchen, even if it's just for morning coffee and donut. I know a priest friend of mine, Father Michael Kerper in Nashua, New Hampshire. He's an old seminary classmate of mine. I didn't make it to priesthood. He did. I can't remember the name of his parish in Nashua, New Hampshire, but it took him a few years, but he actually built a little shelter, emergency shelter, and a kitchen, and now they host the homeless there in his parish, and it attracts all kinds of people, not just the homeless, but the working poor, and they come in for morning coffee and donuts, and then they have other food there, and the more destitute have a place to stay for a while. And so these are all little local, oftentimes my point is these local initiatives are all around us. There's more going on all around us than we realize, in churches, in soup kitchens, in storefront little places that help the poor. If we would just look, if we would just take the time to say, what is going on in my city, in my neighborhood? What organizations are involved in reaching out to the poor? You will find that there are numerous organizations that are out there doing that, and you can volunteer your time. Then what happens is you get networked. You get hooked up with like-minded people. And that goes back to my idea of the real change has to happen on the ground level of creating these little intentional communities of like-minded people. And you will find like-minded Christians that you can then band together with. And you will discover deep and profound friendships that you make. And so this happened to us right when we first moved to the farm. We didn't even have the capacity to take in, but we knew somebody, and they said, hey, look, we know this woman and her son who are refugees from Eritrea. If Eritrea, it's in East Africa, the Horn of Africa. It's called the North Korea of Africa, a very repressive government, very poverty-stricken. Great, courageous young woman fled there with her son, five-year-old, Simone. Her name was Heaven, believe it or not. And she came to the United States, and she was sent to us. And I remember the phone call, and they said, are you ready? I said, it's a little early, but yeah, send her. Send her now. We're not ready, but send her. And we had no idea where she was going to sleep, what we were going to do. But that was the Dorothy Day way, right? Okay. It's all the Mother Teresa way. Don't calculate. Just send. Now, I'm not saying everybody has the means of taking in an Eritrean refugee woman. She stayed with us for 3 months. Now she's in Canada, got political asylum there, and she's doing quite well. Beautiful woman. We were glad we did it. But being open to the Holy Spirit and those kinds of promptings, those kinds of things will happen to you if you but get involved in what local agencies and organizations and churches are. They have boots on the ground doing this kind of work with the poor. It's there if you will but look.
Yeah, and I think what you're doing with the farm and what's so important to emphasize is to try to find opportunities to encounter individuals and to meet people on that level, because that is how you are going to have the biggest impact. Here in Baltimore, I know you were at the Baltimore Basilica relatively recently. There's a great program there called The Source of All Hope, which missionaries come, young people, and they encounter the homeless, the many homeless on the streets of Baltimore, but they encounter them not to necessarily hook them up with a new service right away or anything else, or even to solve their homelessness right off the bat, but to get that, to know them as an individual, to know their name, to know their backstory. And many beautiful things have come out of that. People have been reunited with family members. I know missionaries drove one person all the way down to North Carolina to be reunited with a family member because they became friends. And you do that for a friend. So I think it's, instead of trying to look at people as problems to be solved, look at how can I encounter other people in different situations than myself in which maybe I could have a role to play.
I mean, Abby Steele, she was a young woman involved in The Source of All Hope. And she's been up to our farm a couple times, and the whole, many of the missionaries, those young missionaries, came up to our farm about a year ago, and we took them out to dinner here. We had just the most fantastic time. Yes, and I gave a talk down there on Dorothy Day and theology and stuff. But that is, Katie, that is so true. Look at these young people. They just took the bull by the horns. Okay, none of them are married, and they're probably not going to do this for the rest of their lives. And when they do get married and have children, they may not be able to do it in quite the same sustained way. Youth is a time of idealism. And so if young people are listening to this right now, and yeah, you don't have five kids and a job and a golden doodle, and maybe look at doing something like this, because it can completely alter and change your life and these young people that my wife Carrie and I met doing the Source of All Hope work, they're just doing basic street ministry. They're not doing anything outrageously complicated, just getting to know people. And it's had this powerful and tremendous ripple effect across the way. And even if you only do it for a couple of years in your life, it lays a foundation and you make friends and it's that you become part of a network so that when you do, say, get married and start having children and you need a kind of job to pay the bills, you still have that network in place and you still have the poor in mind. And you start, and this is important, that'd be Dorothy Day as well, that even as you move into a quote unquote more normal sort of life, you try to live a life as materially simple as you possibly can. That is part of the Catholic worker ethos and Dorothy Day's ethos, going all the way back to the church fathers like St. John Chrysostom and Gregory of Nyssa, who said you need to live with as simple a material existence as you can, as befits your station in life. And no Christian should really be super wealthy, super rich, unless they're doing something with that wealth to aid the poor and so on. And so we need to constantly, even as we move away from, say, street ministry, and those kinds of things, and when I'm saying, if I get married, to keep in mind that maybe I don't need two brand new cars, and maybe I don't need a house with six bedrooms, even though I only have two kids and four bathrooms, you know what I'm talking about here. I remember I'm one of five children in my family, and I grew up in a tiny little cracker box of a house in Lincoln, Nebraska. My dad was just a fireman, didn't make a whole lot of money. My mom's a stay-at-home mom. But in other words, they could have afforded a bigger house if they'd have had fewer kids, but they opted for children in a small house rather than two kids in a huge house. So the fewer kids you have, the bigger house you can afford. But why do you need the big house if you only have two kids? So it goes to, now here, I'm not condemning people with small families. I only have one child myself, so I don't want to be a hypocrite. But nevertheless, this is the point that you're bringing up and raising here. You're bringing up the thing about what's going into Baltimore with the Source of All Hope missionaries. That it's important for us always as Christians to keep in view this simplicity of life and the evangelical counsels that we are all called to live.
My husband and I were actually just talking about, we were talking about Tolstoy last night, because whether you agree with how he lived it out or not, Tolstoy is so compelling because he said, look, Christ said this, so I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
And I think that Dorothy Day lived that out. And that's something we really have to grapple with. I've had to grapple with just what is the role of money? What is the role of Christ says very explicit things about the poor and about the sort of life that we're supposed to lead. And I think for me, who is in the, I don't have a golden doodle, but I have a lot of dogs. I have a lot of animals. I have two kids at the moment. So I'm like in that phase of life. Yeah. And I do try to think about how I want my kids to be raised and how, you know, just it's a priority shift. It doesn't mean, you know, it doesn't mean everybody's going to be a desert father, but it does just make sure that your priority list is in place. And I think that's something we should all be
thinking about
a lot.
It's important to talk about children here, because obviously we want, you know, I'm a big pro-family kind of guy, and nothing wrong with people having children. And the more children, the better, as far as I'm concerned, these days anyway. But children are the complicating factor here in living as Dorothy Day lived and living voluntary poverty. When you become a parent, your primary vocation is now to those children. Okay, not to somebody else's children 1,000 miles away, but to those kids in the room down the hall from you. That's your primary vocation at that point. Charity demands, Christian charity demands, therefore, that you attend first to the needs of your children. And therefore, we all get beguiled, I know I did, into this sense of my job is to provide for my kids levels of material comfort, material security, safety, and so on, that is good for them. And so you start building up in your mind this notion of all these things that you need financially and materially for the sake of your children. And of course, depending on where you live, nobody wants their child to suffer the social stigma. Nobody wants their child to suffer the slings and arrows of being radically different from their classmates and so on. And, you know, if I'm, for myself personally, buying all of my clothing from the Goodwill or the Salvation Army or thrift stores of some kind, and none of it's for, do I really want to do that for my kids? When I send my kids to school and they're surrounded by kids wearing designer shoes and designer this, and they're showing up with homemade dresses or jeans they bought at the local Goodwill, those are the kinds of things that grate on a parent's conscience. Am I inflicting my own desire to live the Sermon on the Mount? Am I inflicting a private spirituality on my children in a way that's unfair? Am I imposing my vocation on them? Now, that's a subtle temptation, because what you notice in that temptation is underneath it all is your presumption that what constitutes a normal, healthy life is precisely upper middle-class bourgeois American values. And so you have innately in your soul this fear that unless I'm providing my child with those upper middle-class bourgeois American values, I'm doing something wrong. I'm being unfair to my kids. I'm imposing my vocation on them. It needs to be viewed otherwise. It needs to be viewed as you giving to your children a spiritual legacy, a Christian grounding in a different vision and a different way of life. And it can be done. It can be done properly. And I see people do it. But it's more art than science. And it requires parental skills. And it requires the parent to be an educator and not just a provider. And an example setter and not just a provider. And these are enormously challenging things, but it's a way where if you're going to be a parent and married and that's your primary vocation, then it becomes your almost cruciform task, taking up your cross to provide your children with this Christian insight into what true living is in a manner that's going to put you somewhat at odds with the dominant culture, and to be able to nuance that with your children in a way that doesn't alienate them from you. That's a hard thing to do.
Yes, it's very difficult. My oldest daughter is 2.5, so I haven't had to confront a lot of these things yet. But we're thinking about with school and all sorts of things and what we're going to do. And I also found Rod Dreher's Benedictine Option appealing, but I also didn't love the idea of just squirreling away.
Right.
Just, okay, we're gonna take this good stuff we have and hide and hope that we don't get, you know, hurt in this apocalypse that's coming. Culturally. And so I think that there's a tension in how to be open to the world and want to be charitable to people of all backgrounds and no religion and whatever, and just open to that and see people as human beings primarily, first and foremost, and wanting that for our kids, and also wanting my kids to have their own faith journey that is not just a rote repetition of my own. There's a lot of tension there. I don't have any answers. I'm just raising it.
And obviously you do need to provide the basic material and health needs of your children. I'm not saying that, but it's an art. But with regard to the Benedict option, Roger, I agree, that's the perception of what he's a sort of head for the hills thing. And since so many people seem to say that, maybe there's something to it. But I think underneath it all, I think Rod's basic point is this, that the only way that we as Christians are going to survive the cultural tsunami that's going to sweep over us and is sweeping over us, is we know ourselves and we know what it is we believe and why we believe it. And we have banded together in intentional Christian communities to support one another. It's not about running from the world, but it's about having the tools needed to confront that world. And you won't be able to confront that world or have those tools unless you have a sense of Catholic identity, a strong sense of Catholic identity. And that's what I take Rod's basic admonition to be. That's why it's the Benedict option. You know, the Benedictine monasteries during St. Benedict's time, as the Roman Empire was falling and civilization was collapsing, in one sense, they were retreating from the world. They were in monasteries. But in another sense, those monasteries were totally open to the world. Pilgrims streamed into those monasteries from all over. And the monks taught people basic agricultural skills and so on and so forth. The point being, though, is that the monks preserved civilization in the midst of still being open to this world. So, it's a bit of a retreat, but for the sake of going back, for the sake of giving back. But I'm glad you raised this question, because I don't want to leave the impression at all that what I'm talking about here is we need to develop these little Catholic compounds, as I like to say, where we, with our buried school buses and our squirreled away little hand grenades and scapulars and whatnot.
When I did read the book, and I agree that I don't know if he's fully saying how we always talk about it in that way. I don't know if it's definitive that is exactly what he was advocating for, but I do think that's the impression that can be given. I was just going to say that I think that emphasis, though, that like we can't draw from an empty well, like we need to be cultivating and creating our own culture so that we can go out and share it. And you can't go out into the world and encounter people if you have no community to fall back yes. on. You just can't do it. I think I totally agree that we need this. Yeah, and it's hard. It's very hard to find.
Yeah, and I don't completely agree with Rod's politics, but I think that is his basic insight into things. There's an old Latin phrase, nemo dat quoad non habet. And that means you cannot give away what you do not possess. And so the point is, we cannot give Christ to the world unless we, in some sense, have Christ. And what does having Christ mean? It means living under Christian discipleship, under his lordship. And that requires a certain obedience to a set of actions and activities and dispositions. Yeah. You can't be a Christian and just live and believe any old thing. There are certain things that as a Christian should mark you. And that would be then something, if we live it, then it's infectious. C.S. Lewis said that salvation happens like catching a good infection. And so we need to be that good infection and not the bad infection.
Mm-hmm.
The good infection that people are attracted to and want to be infected by, if you want to put it that way.
Yeah. So I was actually going to bring that up as well as, you know, somebody like St. John Paul II, like people who live a bold, like fully alive life are very appealing to people.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, it's good to not, you know, and as far as like thinking about, oh, our kids not wanting them to be the odd man out. Like, I think about this with smartphones and other things like that. I just am like, if they're weird, that's okay. There's a certain amount where I'm just like, it's okay to be a little different sometimes. Like, we shouldn't be so afraid of that. Especially, I think that right now in the culture, we're put in a very defensive position all the time as Catholics. Oh, I'm against this. I'm against that. But we forget to say like all the things that we're for. We're for the poor, we're for compassion, we're for loving marriages and children and art and the debate, all these good things like that. That is a positive gift we can give to our kids. And when we frame it that way, it doesn't seem as overwhelming so that they can go out then with that sort of positive attitude of like, I have this wonderful gift in my life that I now can share and feel stable in an unstable world.
Oh, I agree 100%. And that was a big part of Dorothy Day's vision too, that St. Francis never really said this, but it's ascribed to him, and it's a good statement. Evangelize always with words when necessary, meaning that normally our evangelization is more through our actions and the attractiveness of our community life together and who we are than it is through overt preaching of the gospel. If people are attracted to who we are and what we're doing, then they'll be interested in what we have to say. Then we say it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not always true. Sometimes you lead with words. Sometimes people really do just want to hear ideas and worldview and theology. Okay, fine, give it to them. But 99% of human beings out there are mainly attracted to a religious perspective because they see the practitioners of that religion living it and living it well. And let's face it, Catholicism is a beautiful religion, with a 2,000-year tradition of mysticism and holiness and saints and mystics and people like St. Francis of Assisi and Mother Teresa. We have a deep well from which to draw, and we need to start drawing from it more. And this is another one of Dorothy Day's points. And we have this great, Peter Morin called it, we need to explode the dynamite of the church. We've been hiding, like Christ said, don't put your light under a bushel basket. That's what Peter Morin was saying when he said, we need to ignite the dynamite of the church. There's so many great things in this church. Let's release the hounds. Let's do it.
Yes.
Let's get out there with our best foot forward.
Yeah, that might be a good place to stop. I have so much more that I could talk with you about, but I think that that is a good positive note to end on. I think it was 3 years ago now, but in the New York Times, there was an article that was something about, it was called like Weird Christians. And it was talking about how the groups that are, you know, growing the most are the communities that would have the more bizarre religious traditions. And I'm not talking about like occult things or something. I'm talking about candlelit masses and things like that, like beautiful things.
Oh, yeah.
That people were really drawn to that. So I think we should, it's okay to be a little weird. As Flannery O'Connor said, you will know the truth and the truth will make you odd.
That's I like to talk all the time about the re-weirding of Christianity. There's good weird and there's bad weird. They're right. There's bad weird. Like little kids that eat paste. That's bad weird. There's good weird. We need to be good weird again.
Yeah, absolutely. Dr. Chapp, thank you so much for taking the time. And I just really appreciate it. Really enjoyed talking with you.
And you too, Katie. Thanks so much.
And here there is something more than just a transient experience.
It's about being. It's about the things that matter to me. It's about the white spaces between the paragraphs.
Then God said, "Let there be light."
The mistake you always made, Doc, trying to love a wild thing.